Good morning. We're continuing in the book of Hebrews. Our passage this morning is Hebrews 6, verses 13 through 20. Hear the word of the Lord. When God made his promise to Abraham, since there was no one greater for him to swear by, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and give you many descendants. And so after waiting patiently, Abraham received what was promised. Men swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all argument. Because God wanted to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed it with an oath. God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope offered to us may be greatly encouraged. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where Jesus, who went before us, has entered on our behalf. He has become a high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Brothers and sisters, this is the word of the Lord.
Interesting passage, isn't it? We're going to unpack that a little bit more as we go this morning, but I want to begin by sharing with you, I recently had seen the results of a study that was done by Daniel Gilbert, professor at Harvard University. He studied what's called the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index and came out with a number of conclusions from his study, including this. He makes the comment that Americans are smiling less, which is ironic because I also read Americans smile more than any other people in other countries. We are people who smile a lot, but we're smiling less according to his study and worrying more than we were a year ago. Happiness is down, he says, sadness is up. We're getting less sleep, we're smoking more cigarettes, depression is on the rise. And states that the reason for this is not, surprisingly, financial or any other reason except uncertainty. Uncertainty is the cause for this rise in what he terms sadness and the increase in depression. People don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of uncertainty. He points to another study in Denmark that took two groups of people, and the first group were told that they were going to receive 20 intensive electric shocks. The other group was told they were going to receive 17 mild shocks and only 3 intensive shots, but they weren't shocks, but they weren't told when those would occur. And the second group had a higher heart rate, had more perspiration and anxiety and discomfort because they didn't know when those stronger shocks were going to come. And Daniel Gilbert summarized this by saying, an uncertain future leaves us stranded in an unhappy present with nothing to do but wait. Our national gloom is real enough, but it isn't a matter of insufficient funds, it's a matter of insufficient certainty. Can you relate to that? Insufficient certainty. Well, there's a lot going on in our world. We have that insufficient certainty when world events cause us to be uncertain, and there certainly are a lot of those going on. We have that insufficient certainty when our nation's leaders foster an environment that's uncertain, where there's a lack of consistent and effective leadership. It can happen when our economy fluctuates and our livelihoods are threatened. It certainly can happen when there are health issues and other issues that press upon us, aren't there? When relationships are infected with contention, we find ourselves with insufficient certainty. The Hebrew Christians found themselves with the same thing. There was insufficient certainty, and there was, as a result, a lot of anxiety and unknown about what the future would be like. You know, as we've been going through, we've seen time and time again, there's been a lot of pressure and persecution and pushback against these people for following Jesus, and they lived with that insufficient certainty. It actually led them to start falling away from Jesus, turning back to old traditions and rejecting their walk with Jesus himself. They weren't obedient to him, and they, in short, were losing hope. So in the passage we just heard, once again, the author is saying, don't give up, but keep on. Persist in that. Remember, as we saw last time, The Hebrew Christians were encouraged to imitate those who persisted until they inherited the promise of God. And it's repeated in this passage once again. In fact, the author says, I want you to be imitating those people, and one in particular, and he refers to Abraham in this passage. Abraham. If we go back to Genesis 12, you'll remember God comes to Abraham and says, got big plans for you. I'm going to make you a great nation. Abraham's 95 years old. His wife Sarah is barren. They're well past the age of bearing children. Remember this? And the promise is your descendants will be more numerous than the stars in the sky. What a promise. And not only that, but I'll give you a land where you can go with this family and dwell in that land and have a relationship with God and be blessed in that relationship. And through them, all nations of the earth would be blessed. Isn't that a tremendous promise given to Abraham? Well past the childbearing years, and yet the promise is for a child. Well past the time we think we have anything to offer the world, and yet here's a promise to bless the whole world through him and his descendants. And Abraham believed it and acted accordingly, as we know. And then we get to Genesis 22, the account where Abraham is told by God to take Isaac, the son. 25 years later, there's a son miraculously given to Abraham and Sarah. The promise is being fulfilled. But what does God ask? Take that son and offer him as a sacrifice to God. Strange thing, isn't it? Abraham, however, is ready to do what God asks, even though he thought this was the fulfillment of the promise, and yet now it's jeopardized. But the author of Hebrews says, don't forget those who went before you, who inherited the fullness of the promise. Imitate them. Imitate Abraham, who was faithful to God's promise, even when he couldn't quite figure out how it was going to be worked out and brought about. But imitate that faithfulness, even when things are uncertain. The author says, look at Abraham, but more importantly, look what God does. He fulfills the promise. He provides a ram for the sacrifice instead of Isaac. The promise of God is fulfilled, and Abraham does become that great nation of people through whom the whole world is blessed. Blessed in particular because out of that nation comes Jesus, who bore the sins of the world, who makes it possible for all people to be in right relationship with God. The promise is fulfilled through Abraham. Interestingly enough, the author does allow us to process probably the things we are thinking, and that is, how can we really trust God's promises? How do we know they're trustworthy? How do we know that when we see God saying, step out here or do this or whatever that might be, that the promises are trustworthy? And the author points to the reality that there is no greater authority by which God can swear that his promises are true than himself. Did you notice that? And God swears an oath to Abraham, but he swears it in his own name, that I will bless you, I'll make your descendants more numerous than the stars in the sky. He swears an oath by his own authority, his own name, and because of that, we can trust the promises of God. Abraham responds to that with both faith and patience. Faith to trust in God's promises and patience to see how God's going to work those promises out. And that's part of the answer for how we need to be trusting God, with faith and patience. Knowing that God does not change, that God does not lie, that God has sworn the promises are true and sworn on the highest authority that there ever could be, and that his own word. Faith and patience. I read about Martin Luther King Jr. Of course, he's known for his nonviolent resistance and his passion for justice. He was a man who had a deep personal faith in Jesus. Charles Marsh is an author who wrote a book about Martin Luther King Jr. It's entitled Welcoming Justice. And he talks in that book about an encounter that Martin Luther King Jr. had with the risen Christ. He says, in January 1956, Martin Luther King Jr. returned home about midnight after a long day of meetings. His wife and daughter were already in bed. He was tired and eager to get to bed himself. But a threatening phone call, the kind that he was getting in those days, as many as 30 or 40 throughout the day, interrupted his attempt to get some rest. He tried to go back to bed. He couldn't shake the menacing voice and the threats that were repeated, the hateful words that he heard echoing through his head. So he got up out of bed, went to the kitchen, made a pot of coffee, sat down, buried his head in his hands, and cried out to God. And there in the kitchen, as Marsh recounts this encounter, in the middle of the night, when Martin Luther King Jr. had come to the end of his strength, he met the living Christ in an experience that would carry him through the remainder of his life. "I heard the voice of Jesus saying, 'Still to fight on,'" King later recalled. "He promised never to leave me, never to leave me. He promised never to leave me, no, never alone." It was in the stillness of that night that the voice of Jesus proved more convincing than the threatening voice of the anonymous caller, writes Charles Marsh. The voice of Jesus gave him the courage to press on through the tumultuous year of 1956, and more than that, it gave him a vision for ministry that would drive him for the rest of his life. Another example, trusting God's promises. Trusting God's promises with faith and with patience, with perseverance, knowing without a doubt that God will honor the promises that have been made. This morning, and Heather, are you there? Where are you? Heather Riggs is going to share with us. She asked if she could tell about a time that was a time of great uncertainty and how she encountered and experienced the promises of God. And we're grateful that you can share with us.
So, singing in front of people, not a problem. Speaking, not so much. I just have to say that we had a family meeting, me, Ken, and Zane, and we sheltered Zane from a lot going through cancer treatment. And I honestly asked him, I said, "Are you okay with this, you know, hearing? Because there's some details that he doesn't know about." And he said, "You know, Mom, I'm just not ready, so that's okay." And Ken heard my testimony a couple weeks ago, so they're in the youth room doing youth group and doing what dudes do. So just in, so you know. September 24th, 2014, I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a blood cancer. Although this was a very trying time in our life, I want to tell you how God was present throughout it all. Beginning when you laid hands on me and lifted me up, where I stayed in his hands the entire time. I haven't been ready to give my testimony until now, and God told me it's time. The summer of 2014 was such a blessing. Myself, Ken, and Zane were blessed to be able to go on the mission trip to Jamaica. Shortly after we got back, I noticed a strange sensation in my neck, and within a short time, there was a lump where my thyroid was. I was sent to an endocrinologist because it was thought to be a thyroid nodule, which are very common. The day before that appointment, I had gotten really bad vertigo, and my mom came down because I couldn't drive. They did a biopsy at the appointment. The doctor said that the substance looked unusual, but he thought it was probably an infection. Then I saw a throat surgeon to discuss having it removed. Needless to say, the last thing on my mind was cancer. I really wasn't worried. So a week later, I saw my family doctor to follow up on the vertigo. And that's when God showed up. I remember Ken had called to ask if I wanted him there, and at first I said no, because my mom was still with us, and I thought it was just going to be a routine appointment. Then something told me to say yes, so we met him at the doctor's office. The doctor came in, sat down, and started pulling up my chart. She wasn't aware of what I'd been dealing with, so we brought her up to speed. Ken then asked if she had the results of the biopsy. She stared at the screen for a couple minutes, clicked around and stared at it again, and without looking up, she just blurted it out. All I heard was lymphoma, which at the time I had no idea what that was. The room went silent. I looked at Ken and my mom, and they were white and had the most awful look on their faces. Then I asked, "You mean cancer?" And the doctor said, "Yes." I felt like the wind had been knocked out of me. Well, things got really interesting after that. Ken ended up fainting twice. My mom's blood pressure went through the roof, and I was kind of pushed into a corner as they worked on both of them. Over the loudspeaker, you could hear, "Patient in distress." After Ken and my mom were stable, we were moved into another room, and I said to the nurse, "This is my support." And she said, "Girl, you better get yourself a second string." Then we all just laughed. And oh my gosh, God knew that's just what we needed at that moment. He was there. God was there even before my diagnosis. 6 months prior, Ken had looked up an old junior high classmate out of curiosity. Sometimes you just wonder what happened to old friends. Well, turns out he is head of oncology back in Syracuse, New York. And Ked said to himself, "Wow, that's so cool. I hope we never need him." Well, Dr. Mariados, or Neil as we affectionately call him, was a saving grace. We were going to get a second opinion, but time was not on our side. He agreed to work in tandem with the oncologist, and not only did he have all my records, he helped us the entire time. I'll never forget the first time we spoke. He said to me, "I will hold your hand through this entire process. Don't worry." I got to meet him in 2015, and I never hugged someone I've never met so tightly. I went through the typical grief cycle: shock, fear, sadness, and then I got mad. How dare the enemy try to take my life? I still had a son to raise and my Prince Charming to grow old with. So I put on my armor and I got ready for battle. I was finally able to see the oncologist 3 weeks after the diagnosis because I had to wait for all the results of my tests to come in. And believe me, there were a lot of tests. But God knew exactly who I needed to be my oncologist. I was supposed to see someone else, but because my tests were delayed, I ended up with Dr. Raja. Originally, I was thought to have the most common form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but there was one more test result to come in. And because I wasn't having the typical symptoms, she was sure nothing would show up to change my diagnosis. Well, 2 days later, after I met with her, she called me and said that the final test had come in and that Ken and I need to come in right away. Well, that's never a good sign. Needless to say, I had Burkitt's lymphoma, which is not only rare, but very aggressive. In fact, tumors have been known to triple in size in 24 hours. She turned out to be just the doctor I needed for my situation. In fact, she went up against her colleagues in a meeting when they thought I should get the less invasive regimen due to me being in stage one, but she didn't want to take a chance. That's when God showed up again. She had made some calls to colleagues across the U.S. Although I definitely had Burkitt's, I was only stage one and not showing any symptoms, so the usual treatment for Burkitt's is one of the most intense treatments out there. She wanted to make sure she was not over or under treating me. As we were sitting there, her nurse came in to tell her she got that call she was waiting for. She came back in 5 minutes and said, "Okay, here's the plan." God didn't want us leaving that room with more worry. So he made that happen. I know it. So I didn't end up getting the Burkitt's treatment, but for instead of 6 months, only three. Praise God. Each round consisted of 2 days of chemo as an outpatient, and then a week later, about 4 days in the hospital with more chemo. Each round also began with chemo being injected directly into my spinal fluid. They weren't messing around with this cancer. Chemo accumulates, so I felt worse after each round, but thankfully had 3 weeks in between to recover. Unfortunately, because of when I started, I had to start my chemo on Thanksgiving and the Christmas holidays. So we just celebrated a week before while I was feeling better. People comment on my strength through it all, but I want to be honest with you. There were times I really did not want to endure anymore because I was so sick and in pain. But I fought for my family. I remember one night asking Ken to take me to the Coronado Bridge so I could jump off. I was in the shadow of the valley of death, or at least it felt like that. So in my desperation, I just kept thanking God in advance for the relief he was going to bring me, over and over, praying with expectation. Then God showed up. I felt his presence so close. It was as if he was sitting on my bed. I pictured him stroking my hair and saying, "I'm here now." I felt peace. Normally, they would do the spinal chemo every other month, but since I was only doing it for 3, they did it every month, which caused a severe spinal headache. I had gotten a slight headache after the 2nd round, but it went away, and after the 3rd round, I was in so much pain that I couldn't lift my head, so Ken had to feed me while I was lying on my back and turned to the side. I had to wear my cotton beanie over my eyes because even the light through my eyelids hurt. The only way I could explain it is it felt like I had the worst migraine and ice cream headache times 100. The pressure was also so bad I thought my head was going to explode. And what's worse, I couldn't stomach any pain meds. We tried everything, but it all made me so sick. Thankfully, I had actually researched spinal headaches after my 2nd round because I was curious what the headaches were from. I had read about a last-ditch procedure called a blood patch, where they inject your blood near the spot of the puncture, the blood coagulates and plugs up the leak. Well, after about 6 days of this pain, I couldn't take any more. Polly had taken me to get fluids for a 2nd day in a row, and I can't tell you how horrible it is to have to ride in a car with that kind of pain and not being able to lie flat. While I was getting the fluids, I begged the oncology nurse to please get the blood patch approved. She came back and said it had been okayed. She felt so bad for me. I'd never seen anybody in this with this severe of a spinal headache. I was sent to the ER for the procedure. When I went to the ER in the past, they got me right in due to me being a cancer patient. But that night, they were slammed. Ken met us there and was very upset that I was being exposed to everyone in the waiting room. People were coughing, sneezing, screaming. It was awful. I was in a wheelchair, but the pain in my head from not being able to lie down was unbearable. Just when I thought I couldn't take anymore, a 2nd seat bench opened up. And that was God. I was able to lie down with my head flat and my legs draped over Ken's lap. 1 hour, then 2 hours, then 3. Ken was getting increasingly agitated and asked me several times if I wanted to get a hotel room close by so we could just leave and come back in a few hours and try again. I told him I just couldn't bear another car ride. I knew that relief was just beyond the doors. I told God, I bargained with him. I said, "Okay, Lord, I'll give you 30 more minutes before I left so that Ken wouldn't stress anymore." I suddenly got the urge to sing. I just started humming the song, "Jesus loves me, this I know." It hurt to speak, so I hummed. I just over and over and over. Ken must have thought I had lost my mind to be singing in this condition. But as I laid there, God showed up. I suddenly felt incredible peace. The noise around me diminished to a mere hum, and for the first time in 6 days, I felt peace. I felt his presence. I knew I was going to be okay. And soon after that, my name was called, and I got some relief. I'm happy to say, as of 1/23/2015, I am healed. This is the day I got the call that my scan was clean, and even though I truly feel I had been healed before then, I obviously don't miss going through treatment, but I do miss the closeness I felt with him in my darkest hours. I can only imagine what it'll be like in heaven. When he was there, all fear, worry, sadness was gone, and there was nothing but peace. I remember when I got the call about my clean scan, Ken was at work, and me and my mom and Zane were at home. Zane was sitting in the living room, and my mom went to Zane, and because we're all jumping up and down excited, and Zane's just sitting in his chair, and my mom said, "Didn't you hear? What's wrong with you?" And Zane said, he just looks up at her and he said, "I already knew." And that's that childlike faith. I learned a lot about Zane. I learned a lot from Zane about childlike faith during the whole experience. It's that unwavering hope that you have without hesitation that we all need to be reminded of every day. Because when you do, God shows up. And I just want to share a quick verse from a dear friend of mine gave me going through treatment. It's from Psalm 116, 1 through 9. "I love the Lord, for he heard my voice. He heard my cry for mercy. Because he turned his ear to me, I will call on him as long as I live. The cords of death entangled me. The anguish of the grave came over me. I was overcome by distress and sorrow. Then I called on the name of the Lord. Lord, save me. The Lord is gracious and righteous. Our God is full of compassion. The Lord protects the unwary. When I was brought low, he saved me. Return to your rest, my soul, for the Lord has been good to you. For you, Lord, have delivered me from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling, that I may walk before the Lord in the land of the living." Amen.